yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at the level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And
Lars.
Now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll bet you thought that President Trump was the only politician in America who is having problems enforcing the law because judges kept getting in his way. And yet, I want to introduce you to another one, and that is Franklin County Sheriff Jim Raymond from the Tri-Cities area. Sheriff Raymond, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
So why is a judge trying to get in the way of you doing your job, and what are you doing to fight back in Franklin County?
Well, what's happened with the judge thing is over the last several weeks, the Board of County Commissioners have tried to seize or take control of the Franklin County Sheriff's Office Correction Center. And
the jail, like the rest of us call it. The jail.
The magistrate protection that's in place in our security building and in the courthouse, which is all ran under the office of sheriff by resolution and so on. So the board and the county prosecutor went to the Benton Franklin County Superior Court judges to get an order to remove those duties from the office of sheriff, and they declined. The judges refused to hear it. So the next step that was taken was they went judge shopping, what I call judge shopping, and found a judge to elevate to the level of a interim or pro tem judge to the courts to sign an order ordering me to not remove weapons from the facility, property, and so on and so on. Knowing that efforts were underway already to recover the guns. And that's been done.
Well, let's go back to the jail issue, if you don't mind, Sheriff. Why does the county, why does the county commission want to take over operations of the jail, which in almost every one of America's 4,000 counties is in the hands of the local sheriff?
Because they believe they have the authority to do so, and they don't. I think in the end you'll find that what's taking place across the country with the jails being taken over, like to bureaus of correction and stuff, they're being done in conjunction with an agreement with the sheriffs across the country or state if they choose to do that. And the problem with that is I never agreed to that. I just got hit cold in the face with it all without any foreknowledge or anyone sitting down and going, hey, sheriff, are you willing to give up your fully accredited corrections facility that's about to be accredited again in May? Hand it over to the Board of County Commissioners to screw it up? The answer would have been no. I'm not.
Well, in fact, Sheriff, does anybody on the county commission have any experience in law enforcement or the operations of jails or prisons?
Well, the answer is no. Commissioner Didier, as you know, is a retired NFL football player and a local farmer. I know that he graduated from Portland State with a criminal justice degree, but he's never utilized it in any fashion. Commissioner Rocky Mullins is a rancher and a farmer and has the sum zero of the same. The other commissioner who's working systematically to tear apart the jail at the moment is Commissioner Steve Bauman, who literally is a land developer in the county, and that's the sum total of his experiences in law enforcement. But
so, Sheriff Raymond, what is pushing them to want to do this? I mean, do they want to turn all the inmates loose or what?
No. So there was the state come in and did an audit of
the commissary. Yep.
Commissary funds and the our medical contracts in the jail. Okay. And clearly if you go to the state auditor's website, you're gonna see that the postings of the findings are on their website, and they say this: commissary funds. The county lacks policy and practices that aren't in bars compliance, and the findings are against the county, not the sheriff.
If we translate that to English, they're saying the vendor, the private sector vendor who was doing the commissary, selling, I don't know, bags of chips and soda pop to the inmates, or toothbrushes or soap, let's hope, that they weren't paying the county what the vendor owed. Is that what they said?
That's it. Yeah. Well, but in that instance, they have been paid. So the commissary contract for things that are by law don't have to be in commissary. And I'll use a real simple example. A cheeseburger. You know, one of the inmates wants a cheeseburger. When that cheeseburger is sold to them, there's a 70-30 split of that cheeseburger. 70% the vendor retains, 30% comes to the county. Okay.
So the county makes a profit on it.
They do. Yep. And so
the vendor has to supply the materials and the labor and delivery and all the rest of that. The county just sits back and collects some dough.
You got it. Yeah, in its simplest form. So since the contract was implemented, no one was paying attention if the county was getting their money. And it actually should have been the responsibility of the treasurer for that. So as we were looking through all of our financials and trying to be BARS compliant, we found that, hey, this vendor hasn't been paying the county. And so we picked up the phone and called and said, hey, vendor, where's this money? Oh, I'm sorry. We forgot to send it. Okay. How much is it? How much is in there?
It was 90 grand, wasn't it?
Yeah, close to $90,000. And now that money, we facilitated it being returned to the county, and the county has the money. So the
you
findings,
must not have Democrats on your county commission, Sheriff, because most Democrats can smell a dollar about a mile away, and they're never shy about trying to collect that money. So they were owed 90 grand. They didn't even know they were owed it.
No, you're a little off there.
Oh.
As in $900,000.
Oh, 900 grand. Okay. That's You would think even a Republican could smell that kind of tax revenue.
Especially being our auditor and our treasurer are Republicans.
Well, you'd think they know where the money is. But, Sheriff, I'm up against a time break, but that's Sheriff Jim Raymond from Franklin County. He's fighting for control of his jail. The judge even tried to take his guns away and say, you're not even allowed to move the guns that you have stored at the jail just in case there's, you know, something like a riot or something like that. And the county commission, not exactly keeping a close eye on the books.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, it's Doctors.
Follow Lars on Blue Sky at Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. You know, the Minneapolis Hennepin County Attorney's Office wants to require its prosecutors to consider race when negotiating plea deals. Is that a step toward justice or a blatant disregard for the Constitution? Zach, I would imagine that even a first-year law student would be able to say, well, that's not equal protection under the law. Zach, by the way, is Zach Smith, legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation and co-author along with Cully Stimson of the book Rogue Prosecutors. Zach, welcome back to the program. And what should we make of what's going on in Hennepin County?
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Lars. It's great to be with you. And look, we should make of what's happening in Hennepin County as a blatant disregard for the Constitution and, frankly, for the rule of law. What's happening is horrifying because the elected Soros-backed DA there in Minneapolis, Minnesota, is essentially instructing her assistants to treat defendants differently based on their race. That is something that is antithetical to the Constitution. That's something that is antithetical to the rule of law, and this district attorney should be held accountable for implementing these explicitly race-based requirements.
Well, in fact, she seems to admit that. Let me read the sentence that you cited in the Daily Signal. While racial identity and age are not appropriate grounds for departure from the sentencing guidelines, proposed resolutions should consider the person charged as a whole person, including their racial identity and their age. Do they teach you in law school, or does somebody teach people like Mary Moriarty in law school? You can write a sentence, and as long as you start with part of it that contradicts the last part of it, if you got the result you wanted, then that's okay.
Well, she certainly needs to go back to law school if that's what she took away from her legal writing class. Look, this policy is so bad, Lars, that a University of Minnesota law professor, he even said that you can't have it both ways. Even though she says don't take race into account, she immediately then says you should consider race. And once you say that a district attorney, prosecutor should consider race, that takes the entire process and makes the entire process that involved that racial consideration unconstitutional and unlawful as well.
Well, and the other opinion she threw in that you also cited, racial disparities harm our community, lead to distrust, and have a negative impact on community safety. Except that, Zach, if I'm right, and I think I've got the numbers right on this because we've talked about, we talk about these all the time, you have black males who are 6.5% of the population. Black people are 13% of the population. Males are about half of that. They commit somewhere between 50 and 52% of the homicides. Apparently, Mary Moriarty finds it inconvenient that black Americans commit a disproportionate number of murders when compared to other ethnic groups, including white people, Hispanic people, and Asian people. Well, she may find it inconvenient, but she's saying that if we convict too many black people, that's going to make Minneapolis feel bad?
That's essentially what she's saying, Lars, and it's not only insane, it's dangerous, and again, it's unlawful. Look, we've talked about it before. There are a number of sociological reasons for why it's true that young black men commit a disproportionate number of violent crimes in our country, but the fact is, once someone, regardless of their race, has committed a crime, they have to be held appropriately accountable for their actions, and simply not prosecuting someone because of their race or seeking harsher penalties because of their race, all of that is inappropriate and unlawful. And in fact, Waters, there's a federal law on the book. It's 18 U.S.C. 242 that essentially says that if someone acting under color of any state law, statute, ordinance, regulation, or custom willfully deprives someone of the rights, privilege, or immunities protected by the Constitution or the laws of the United States, then that person, himself or herself, it can in fact be federally prosecuted for essentially using their power, their state power, to treat someone differently, deprive someone of a right or privilege they're entitled to because of their race. And there's a very good argument that that is essentially what Mary Moriarty is doing there in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And thankfully, because President Donald Trump appointed Pam Bondi as the Attorney General, because he appointed Harmeet Dhillon as the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Civil Rights Division, the DOJ is now investigating whether this rogue radical district attorney in Minneapolis is in fact violating federal anti-discrimination laws with this terrible policy.
And do we, Zach, let me ask you a legal question. Do we have to wait until she's actually done this in a case before they can go after her? Or can they go after her and say the very fact that you've stated this as the official policy of your office, we don't have to wait for you to actually hurt people. We can go after you now.
Well, what I can say is this policy is already in place, Lars. It's already been in place for a couple of weeks at this point. And so we know that the assistants in her office have been evaluating cases under this rubric that Mary Moriarty established. And so since that's the case, I would certainly think that the DOJ is well within its prerogative to potentially take legal action against Moriarty or any of her assistants if there's evidence that they have willfully violated the rights of those whom they have whose cases they've evaluated under this, this policy.
Can her deputy DAs or deputy prosecutors use the "I was just following orders" excuse that didn't work out too well after World War II, or are they going to be held responsible as well?
Yeah, I suspect everyone who uses or engages in race-based discrimination under this policy could be subjected to liability. Obviously, I think, you know, Mary Moriarty would likely bear the brunt of the blame since she promulgated this, required this of her deputies. But you're absolutely right, DG. You know, just following orders, line of defense is not appropriate, particularly for prosecutors, Lars. Keep in mind, lawyers, but particularly prosecutors, have their own independent ethical duties. And if they think what they are being asked to do, what they are being ordered to do, violates the law or violates their own ethical duties, then they have, at a minimum, an obligation to resign and not participate in that type of behavior. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. But I think it is a very encouraging sign that the U.S. Justice Department, particularly the formerly very radical Civil Rights Division, is, you know, clearly turning over a new page and investigating this very harmful conduct under Assistant Attorney General Parmeet Dhillon.
You know, Zach, I'd find it a lot more encouraging. Were any of her deputies brave enough to stand up and say, "Hey, boss, I'm not doing this. You're asking me to treat black and white people differently. I'm not doing it." Did she get any pushback at all that we can tell?
I haven't seen any of that that's been publicly released, Lars. But look, I think Parmeet Dhillon, in the wake of the announcement that she was investigating this policy in Minneapolis, she posted a follow-up tweet on X where she said she's hearing from more and more people who work in offices, DA offices around the country, that this type of behavior is far more widespread, far more invidious than was previously imagined. And, you know, we heard the same thing when we were writing our Rogue Prosecutor's book. We heard from many deputies around the country that they were being asked to engage in similar types of conduct. You know, it's much harder to prove the case when there's not an explicit policy in place. This is low-hanging fruit because Mary Moriarty very dumbly put her policy in writing. What's much harder to do is prove it when you have DAs paying lip service to the idea of equality, but in fact engaging in a pattern or practice of treating people differently based on race. But I'm confident that, again, the Civil Rights Division at DOJ is now aware of the problem and will look into it to make sure that all Americans are treated equally.
That is Zach Smith from Heritage and also the author of Rogue Prosecutor. Zach, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to The Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your calls, and we'll do that in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. By the way, today dawned with the news that Honda is preparing to significantly expand its U.S. manufacturing footprint in response to the Trump tariffs. What's happening now? Well, Honda is now shifting production of key models from Mexico and Canada to the United States with the goal of ensuring that 90% of the cars it sells in the U.S. are built domestically. So the question on the X poll, have the Trump tariffs already boosted made in America? I would answer yes to that. You can answer it any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, around the country, it seems that inflation is starting to cool, that it may even be moving downward for America as a whole. But how about here in the Pacific Northwest? Mark McMullen is Vice President of Policy and Research at Common Sense Institute of Oregon. Mark, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So should Oregon and Washington and Idaho be seeing inflation at least slow down, if not go down, based on what's happening around the country?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of risks still going forward. The recent inflation data has been very encouraging. So the Pacific region still running a little hotter than the average region, but we have seen improvement in line with everywhere else, where we saw a little bit of pause in some of these inflationary measures earlier in the year. And now as of March, we started to see a little bit more improvement.
So when we saw that the overall inflation index was down from 2.8% nationally to 2.4% in February, it's still moving upward, but it's not moving upward as fast. And it's still above the Federal Reserve target of 2%. But should those same things happen here in the Northwest? And is there anything in the region that would push against that and push it the other direction?
Yeah, so we are getting closer to the Federal Reserve's target. There are a lot of different measures of inflation. The most recent that came out was the Consumer Price Index. But no matter what measure you use, wholesale prices or their preferred measure, the personal consumption expenditures or the like, we have seen improvement both here and in the U.S. as a whole. And so we fall somewhere between 3% and the 2% target. Now in the Pacific Northwest, over the last several years, our issue has really been in energy prices and housing prices. And we are seeing a little bit of less pressure on both of those fronts, where a lot of our inflation nowadays is coming through food and through medical services and broader service industries.
I guess I wonder about those three things, and do you mind if I ask about them separately? In the case of housing, both the state of Oregon and the state of Washington are looking at increasing rents and increasing home prices simply because the two states, while they talk a good game about increasing the supply of housing, the government rules that stand in the way seem to be, you know, not going the direction they want to go. Governor Kotek had promised when she ran for office that she would double the amount of housing production. It has fallen instead. And I guess I'm not an economist, but if you reduce the supply of something, or if the population increases and the amount of housing does not increase, then prices are going to go up. It doesn't sound like housing is a bright spot for the Northwest. Both Oregon and Washington have all these anti-housing measures, things like rent caps and eviction moratoria and things like that. Is there an indication that housing is going to go down in price?
Well, there are some positive signs, particularly for multifamily housing, where we're seeing vacancy rates increase, which, you know, the more empty space they have, you know, rents do tend to go down over time. And so that is, you know, encouraging. But as you say, we still have a significant undersupply. A hole that we have to dig ourselves out of in terms of the broader housing market. Now, with these particular inflationary measures, it's become very difficult to dissect out what's going on in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest in particular, given that now the Department of Commerce, as of a few years ago, no longer produces numbers for the Salem and Portland consolidated region. Instead, we just get numbers for the Pacific region.
Why did they make that change? And Mark, why did they make that change and no longer gather the numbers that would tell us where we're going? What? Who decided to do that?
It certainly wasn't me. It was a budget cutting move, and they decided to just report Pacific region. And, you know, unfortunately, of course, California is so big that it's hard to see through some of those numbers. But like you say, there's still a drastic concern about the undersupply of housing throughout the region. And there's no question that's putting upward pressure on prices.
Okay, and then on energy, it doesn't seem like energy is going to go down at all. In fact, if anything, the things that make it push up, things like lawsuits against power companies because of wildfires, and that's happened, and we've seen big, big judgments in those cases, and you've got to push by the region to go to wind and solar that is more expensive and to eliminate things like hydro and coal, which are less expensive. Is there any indication that energy prices are going to start flattening out, or are they going to keep on going up as well?
Well, as you say, there are a lot of issues in terms of the policy impact on energy prices, particularly, of course, transportation prices. As we go forward, and we are putting together a transportation package here in Oregon, it most certainly will include increased fuel taxes as we go forward. And in our region, we've always been a little bit of helpless in terms of what's going on with our refinery network, and so far as there are a lot of bottlenecks that can't really be predicted. And more generally, obviously these energy markets are global in nature, and so there's going to be a lot of volatility that doesn't have to do with the local policies. But that said, we can expect the pressure from local policies to continue to increase. There are a lot of proposals out there in the legislature right now, like you say, in order to police some of the utility companies, both for increasing rates and in terms of where they get their supplies and in terms of protecting against the liability for wildfires and the like. And when you couple those with what's happening in the transportation sector in terms of revenue generation, yeah, locally there's going to be upward pressure on prices for sure.
Mark, I appreciate the time. That's Mark McMullen, who's Vice President of Policy and Research at Common Sense Institute of Oregon. And by the way, when it comes to food, the third area that he mentioned, consider this. Fuel costs go up, that drives food prices up. Minimum wages go up, that drives food prices up. New limitations that you must pay overtime to farm workers who work beyond, 40 or 50 hours a week. That's going to drive prices up. And then, of course, you've got the cage-free chicken problem, which may be why the egg prices are so high on the West Coast. Oregon, Washington, and Idaho all decided to go with the cage-free, even though it's not a very sensible policy. If you talk to the farmers about it, it makes the birds more susceptible to disease, and of course, it makes the price of eggs go up as well. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk to our friend Seton Motley, president of the group called Less Government, about why small businesses in America are holding back on hiring new employees. Hey, Seton, welcome.
Hey, man, how are you?
Not too bad. And as you point out, the U.S. job market is seemingly strong. 4% or so unemployment doesn't sound too bad. But we have millions of people who are, of working age, able-bodied adults and not disabled, sound of mind, sound of body, et cetera. And they're not going to work. And we have small businesses that may be holding back in their hiring. Is there a reason for that?
Well, I wrote the article, and then, of course, you start get how these companies track you now. It turns out that I wrote the article about like the last year, give or take.
Yeah,
it turned like I subsequently found articles going back to like 2014, small businesses not hiring, and this fits right in line with my analysis of the last 50 years, which is as the government started selling out the country to foreign, you know, to big business and foreign manufacturing. And that, then they move over there. They get favorable trade status over there. They get subsidies from the from those governments. They get protected over there. Then they, when they re-import their subsidized stuff, it further undercuts small businesses, which causes more of them to either go out of business or, if they can afford to do so, leave the country. And then it's a lather, rinse, repeat for 50-plus years, going back to when Nixon first sent Kissinger to China when they were still shooting at us in Vietnam. And this has been going on for decades. And this is, and of course, one of the ugly little aspects of this is when these companies move overseas, they go from lobbying for less government inside the U.S. to more.
Yep.
Because they now benefit, because they're not affected by the bigger government, but their opponents are, their competitors are, the ones that are too small to move or unable to move that they're competing with, they're stuck with the greater government. So this has been, you know, and I admire what Trump's trying to do, and he's got 4 years to undo 50, and I just don't know. I think it's a longer-term project than that.
Well, although I understand the problem you're talking about, but then that gives you an even better piece of leverage to say to Congress and to the bureaucracy, which Trump is at least nominally in charge of, you've got to roll back a lot of these regulations and make this a great place to manufacture again, right?
You, of course, you and I text, you know, throughout the weeks and months and whatever. And one of the ideas I had that I put in a piece last week was every time Trump issues an executive order, somebody in the House, somebody in the Senate should file a bill with language as close to the executive order as possible, so we don't go back and forth. And, you know, Biden undid everything Trump did within a week because there was no congressional backing to what Trump did. Congress watches 9 million brilliant executive orders fly by, and the one they back with legislation is the Gulf of America. I have trouble taking Congress very seriously.
Well, and the other thing that this could do, Seton, throw those things in the hopper. You've got
put
the majority.
Put it on record.
Put them on record saying, no, we don't want concealed carry reciprocity. No, we don't want this. No, get them all on record. And then all of the next 18 months, just tell Americans, these are all the things the Democrats are not in favor of. And that's
right.
Go ahead.
And Trump's, it's amazing considering he hasn't been a politician his whole life. Trump's the best I've seen in my lifetime at identifying 80-20 issues and highlighting them. And like you said, if we put those 80-20 issues on the floor in Congress and made the Democrats vote on the 20 side over and over and over again, you know, right now I argue that the Republicans are winning by default. They're not winning. They're just the taller,
the least worst, the least worst.
And yes, and the only person that's doing any good work is Trump. And I don't want to sound like a Trump sycophant because I'm not, as you know. But you know, I said after the 2020 election, when the election was stolen, I said now would be the time where it might actually work to start a new party. Take the 80+% of Republicans that Trump had with him in 2020, he'd get 20% of the Democrats to start, and that number would grow, and that would be one of the few times where a new party would actually work. And have I seen any evidence from Republicans since 2020 that that's a terrible idea? I don't think I have.
No, and what's sad about it is if we did those, lock in a bunch of this stuff, then the Democrats have to go back to Capitol Hill and try to unlock it, and most of them won't have the stomach for it. And in the meantime, go on and accomplish more things, but make
now,
it locked
now
in.
It's now it's legislation, and even though 400 of the 435 House seats are gerrymandered beyond recognition and the general elections don't matter, in those 35 seats that do, they're going to be really embarrassed if you've locked some stuff in that's 80-20 and then say, okay, now we're going to vote the new speaker, the Democrat speaker says, we're going to reverse these 80-20 issues and vote on the 20% side. And these 35 Democrats are going to go, wait a minute, what are you talking about? I can't vote for any of this crap.
No, you can't. Seton Motley from Less Government. Seton, thank you very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, we choke on the smoke in the Pacific Northwest every single year. We see billions of dollars in public timber go up in flames. We pass up tens of thousands of Northwest forest jobs, and then on top of that, the taxpayers get to pay literally hundreds of millions of dollars to put out the fires that never should have happened. I want to talk to Dr. Bob Zybak about that. He's a forest scientist and president of Northwest Maps Company and the author of the Zybak Forest Anthologies, a series of four anthologies of articles, editorials, interviews, and reports about forest and wildfire history. Dr. Zybak, welcome back.
Thank you, Lars. Good to be back.
You've talked about this problem, and we've talked about this problem with you for a long, long time. Where do we stand right now, and how do we get to something that's sensible where we don't let the forests of the Northwest just burn up every year?
Well, we've talked about this since a biscuit fire more than 20 years ago, and we know what to do to fix the problem. We didn't have this problem between World War II and the spotted owl. The problem's twofold. One, we're letting our forests burn up. We're not managing them. The fuels are building up, and so we have the predictable wildfires through the green trees. And then after they're burned, we don't salvage them as we did for the previous thousands of years. We let them sit there. And so these trees filled with water turn into firewood filled with pitch. And so the resulting burns, we've known that since the 1930s and 40s with the Tillamook fires, are even worse. So the result is we've, Kalmiopsis wilderness has now burned four times as predicted. And we're going to continue having these fires, and they're going to continue being worse for those reasons.
I mean, the result you just mentioned, burning up of a wilderness four different times, sounds like the kind of thing where you could actually get pro-forestry and logging people and the tree huggers on the same side for a change and get them to push something through. Is that happening?
Not at all. The tree huggers, the Kalmiopsis used to be a mining district with a county road through it, so it's an artificial wilderness. It's a rough, rugged country, but even on prescribed burns on restoration projects, if the environmentalists, and I'm going to put quotes around it, can file lawsuits, they do. So they've got teams of lawyers that have been paid by taxpayers to put an end to active forest management with the predictable result that we have these catastrophic wildfires.
Well, what should overrule that, I would think, would be the legislatures of both Oregon and Washington. I know your focus is mostly Oregon, but Washington State as well, because they have a similar problem. Hundreds of millions spent every year to put out fires that shouldn't be happening at all. If we change forest management, and actually forest management that would actually make money and generate revenue to pay for all that fire prevention and, if needed, fire extinguishing. But do you see any sign that the two legislatures or the governors of the two states are getting the message?
It's a broader problem than that. Northern California is just as bad, and same with Colorado, New Mexico, and Idaho. It's national forest land, so it's a federal problem. The state problem, we're following suit with HCPs, habitat conservation plans and buffers and roadless areas and so on. So we're creating our own problems. But it's a national problem because these are national forests that are being mismanaged and turned into fire bombs and causing poverty in our rural communities where there should be really good paying jobs, as it were, during our childhoods and young adult years.
Well, and in fact, Dr. Zybak, I take your point that an awful lot of these fires are on the national forest lands, fewer on the state forest lands, almost none on the well-managed private forest lands. But even there, I mean, I pointed out to people, they say, well, that's federal forest land. Oregon and Washington have nothing to say about it. I said, check with California. California has a massive amount of, for example, oil and natural gas off its coastline. Why are we not seeing new oil wells punched out there? Because the state of California says to the federal government, no, we're not going to let you do that, even though those lands belong to the federal government. They belong to all the people of the United States, not just the state of California, the offshore lands where they would drill. In the same way, the national forests, yes, are under the management of the ownership of all the American people, but the management of the federal government. But the governors of the two states could go to the federal government, especially now with Donald Trump, and say we'd like different forest management policies adopted. And I have a feeling they'd find a friendly ear with the head of USDA, because they're in charge of the Forest Service. Wouldn't they have a real good opening right now to go to the federal government and say, manage these forests differently. We don't need the fires every year. But they're not doing that, are they?
Not at all. That's the problem. Can you imagine our Governor Kotek going to the president and asking for more active management of our land? And they've shut down the Elliott for carbon credits. That's the problem is, we used to manage these fires locally. Even the federal government had district rangers that lived in the community. And for thousands of years, fires have always been fought locally. Once we went over to federal management and federal regulations, mostly in the 1980s and 1990s, and we allowed environmentalists to sue the government to stop logging and to stop putting out fires, and then had taxpayers cover those costs, things have changed. So it's a real identifiable problem, real predictable fires. If our governors took charge, we would need new governors because we don't have those types of representatives in place now.
Well, and I guess I see the irony that Tina Kotek and Bob Ferguson, both of them, have been saying, we're going to go to the Trump administration and demand they give us money. Well, how about demanding that they give you something that can be given without having to change, you know, without having to write a check? They seem to be all concerned about the money. How about just change the way the Forest Service manages all those lands? Instead of burn, baby, burn, let's put the fires out and get a real cooperative arrangement between the federal government and the state government. When a fire starts, everybody put it out. Forget about the political boundaries. And they could do that right now. And I want Republicans to start asking that question about Bob Ferguson and Tina Kotek.
And not only that, if we salvage the dead trees after a fire, or better yet, thinned out the trees before a fire, we would be sending money to D.C. as we did for generations, rather than having to go there and ask for money for who knows for what. But the ability of our forests to provide housing for the poor, to provide jobs, blue-collar jobs, to revitalize our rural communities and counties is right there. And we're asking for money instead of going to work. And that's the bottom line.
And that is the sad statement. That's Dr. Bob Zybak, forest scientist, president of Northwest Maps Company, author of Zybak Forest Anthologies. Dr. Zybak, thanks so much. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
We'll be right back. Everyone's favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. EJ Antoni joins me now, research fellow for regional economics in the Center for Data Analysis at Heritage. EJ, welcome back.
Well, Lars, thanks for having me again.
So I'm not going to talk to you about the airplane. We've been talking about the jet from Qatar too much already today, but that's all right. I don't mind if people want to talk about that. I mean, I'm sure the Democrats have been anxious to shout the emoluments clause for months now. Let me ask you about the jobs and the Biden administration and some of the funny business that appears we're now finding out to have been done with the jobs numbers when Joe was still in office.
Oh, my gosh, Joe. Yeah, this is just something we've talked about over and over again, how Joe Biden repeatedly, his Labor Department would release these overly optimistic estimates for jobs. They were always talking about how, hey, we've added 200, 300, 400,000 jobs to the economy in the last month. And then the numbers would be quietly revised down over the next month or two. And then we would get these annual reports that look back over the course of 12 months and revise everything down. You know, the most recent one showed a drop of 600,000 jobs.
Holy cow. It's
amazing. Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, all of these jobs that we thought we had never even existed. So now we look at what the latest estimates are going to be, and what we're finding essentially is that we're in store for another massive drop. So, for example, in the middle of last year, the second and third quarter combined, you know, we thought the economy added like 800,000 jobs. Turns out it was nowhere near that. Turns out on net, we probably were losing jobs during that time. And look, Lars, I think this helps explain why, despite all of the incredibly rosy headlines when it came to the labor market, the American people in polls were incredibly dissatisfied. And they voted Trump back into office by a pretty wide margin, right? They gave him not just the electoral vote, but the popular vote, every swing state. Why? Because they're looking around at their own personal finances and at the local economy around them, and they're seeing it's pretty lousy, and it doesn't match up with the headlines because the headlines were wrong.
Well, and with all due respect to economists, especially those in the current conversation, they were paying attention to what they actually saw and observed with their own eyes and heard with their own ears instead of listening to all the numbers coming out of D.C., which is not a bad back check on almost anything. You say everything's rosy. The forecast is sunny. And I walk outside and I'm getting wet and I say, oh, no, I think it's raining, despite what the weatherman says. This is what they were doing last year. And I guess I want to ask, and I don't know if there's a way to know this, EJ, but were they doing it knowing that the numbers were fraudulent?
Great, great question, Lars. So this is where I like to say that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is part of the Department of Labor, I like to say the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, committed a sin of omission here, if not a sin of commission. And the reason I want to, you know, distinguish that is because, look, I have absolutely no evidence, to be perfectly clear. I have no evidence that anybody was cooking the books, you know, making up numbers. But right. what we do have evidence of is that after 2020, after COVID, because of the radical changes in our economy, a lot of the different statistical models or the methodologies that we were using to compile these reports and come up with these estimates, you know, a lot of them no longer worked anymore, or they didn't work as well. They started becoming increasingly inaccurate. The numbers were going all over the place. That first became apparent in March of 2022. So if we're now 2 years after the fact, which is when the time period that we're talking about here, when all these jobs that were supposedly added didn't exist, it's 2 years later, the BLS is well aware that there is a problem with their statistics, and they chose to do nothing to fix it. And now here we are 3 years after those problems first arose, and I still haven't seen anything done by the bean counters in the government to address these problems.
I mean, so, but EJ, this is the kind of thing that, I mean, the whole climate debate suffers from this. because they say, well, we're taking all these official temperature measurements. Yeah, except that you were taking temperature measurements in a cow pasture 50 years ago that was next to the airport, and now the cow pasture is covered with asphalt and roofs and all that, so there's a heat island effect. And even the folks in climate will say, well, then you need to adjust those numbers because we know that otherwise they would suffer from, you know, they'd give you an aberrant result. They'd be telling you, wow, it's getting, you know, it's getting hotter, it's getting cooler, whichever it happens to be. Can you give us an idea of why the folks who run those departments and generate those numbers wouldn't say our measuring system is not working and we need to fix it, or at least acknowledge it and say these numbers are likely high or they're likely low?
I hate to say this, Lars, but I think you either have to say they're incompetent or they're being malicious here, right? Because don't forget, a lot of government bureaucrats, not all, there's some very good ones, but a lot of government bureaucrats are staunch Democrats. They are ardent liberals, and they had a preferred candidate that they wanted to get across the finish line. I mean, let's be honest, it's the same reason why the Federal Reserve cut interest rates last fall, because they wanted to get the Democrat across the finish line. If you look at the those people who are employed by the Federal Reserve, over 90% of them donate, in terms of political contributions, donate exclusively to Democrats, over 90%. You can't tell me that organization doesn't have some kind of institutional bias. And frankly, we find the exact same thing among federal employees.
Well, and in fact, that's one of those things where I think about it this way. It doesn't take much of a nudge that if you say, I've got to take all these numbers and they all have to either be rounded up or rounded down. And you don't even have to think consciously, I want to make Joe look good or I want to make Trump look bad. All you have to do is give it a nudge one direction or the other. And all of a sudden, all of the numbers change dramatically. But if somebody came to you and said, how did you justify rounding down there instead of rounding up? Well, you know, because we always round down, or we usually round down, or I believe that it was a round down instead of a round up. It wouldn't take much of that, would it? When you're talking about a few hundred thousand jobs out of about 168 million workers, you wouldn't have to work very hard to make it look dramatically different, would you?
I think that's a very good assessment. And again, to be clear, I'm not alleging that anybody said, hey, let's go in here and change these numbers, right? Instead, what appears to have happened, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, is that it was evident that the numbers were wrong, and people looked at it and said, well, it's benefiting my preferred candidate, so might as well just leave it. No reason to change it, right? If it ain't broke, don't fix it, even though it clearly is broke. But again, it was advantageous politically to not change these things, so they were left exactly as they were.
Well,
and look, Lars, it's not as if revisions are somehow an aberration, as if they never happen. Revisions are routine. We get better data as time goes on, but it should look like what we call a random walk. 1 month is revised up, the next is revised down, the revisions are all relatively small, and over time it averages out to zero. Instead, what we saw under Biden was repeatedly these jobs numbers getting revised not up but down over and over again, and by very large numbers.
It sounds like it. E.J. Antoni from the Center for Data Analysis at the Heritage Foundation. E.J., thanks so much for the time. Your emails are welcome. talk@LarsLarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed where you'll find I've got a face for radio.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Daily question to all the Dems in our government.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Now, the one with the brain, Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network on a Tuesday, and a real pleasure to welcome back Carlene Johnson, who's staff reporter for the Center Square. Carlene, welcome back.
Hi, nice to talk to you, Lars. Happy beautiful Tuesday.
It is a beautiful Tuesday. I want to ask you about the Seattle PD and how they're getting more officers on board. But first, I want to point something out, and that is, I don't know if you heard, but Pam Bondi, the new AG, had announced the largest, apparently the largest fentanyl seizure in American history, and I didn't realize it has a Northwest connection. The leader of the criminal group that is now accused in this, they arrested a bunch of people and took about 11 and a half pounds of fentanyl and about 35 pounds of meth and 3 million fentanyl pills and all the rest of that. He's living in Salem, Oregon, or was living in Salem, Oregon, until and what a surprise, straight up the I-5 corridor from Mexico, right?
Yeah, it's probably not a surprise. Yeah, I had the pleasure of being down in Albany over the weekend, Lars, to attend my my fiance's family gathering, and so drove up through, and it seemed like everything was lovely, lovely, lovely until we got closer and closer to Portland coming back home yesterday, and I was like, here we are. Now it's starting to look like Seattle.
Yeah, it looks just like
Seattle.
And it's sad. Every time I go to Seattle, I see the chaos and you know what's driving it. I mean, they can tell all the stories they want about the homeless, but we know that drugs and alcohol are driving probably 80% of what you're seeing out there. So let's talk about the cops, because I started today with, there were protests at both PSU and UW for different reasons. Right. UW was, we hate the Jews, and PSU was, we hate anybody who's a straight white female because she doesn't want to swim or run against males. Riley Gaines was speaking there. But here are the cops at the UW campus, and they're being backed down by a crowd. And they're saying, back up, back up. And the cops are just giving ground all day long. It doesn't seem like police forces in the Northwest are in a particularly strong position right now.
They are not, and they haven't been since, well, honestly, prior to the pandemic. But, Seattle, like Portland, right at the heart of, international embarrassment, right, with all of the BLM riots, burned down the city, police are told to back down, and, then the subsequent defund the police movement now. Seattle has made an attempt to remedy things since, because it is bad. And let me tell you, I'll just add anecdotally, I was in Federal Way where I live, Lars. I was T-boned by a driver yesterday and injured. I'm working from home today, and I'm not on meds, so we're good. But,
oh, good for you. Sorry.
Yeah, but I was thrilled with the response of, local police and firefighters who responded. So to have those people come when you need them is hugely important. And so you never know when you're going to need them. And in that moment, if you can't get an officer to respond when you're injured and you're scared, that's when you go, wow, we probably shouldn't have defunded the police. So I just use that as a backdrop of somebody who, like 14 hours ago, needed them to come.
Well, and to your point, Carlene, about them being underfunded, both Portland and Seattle were running way below full strength in cops way before the pandemic. And we've done the story for years. When you look at the number of cops per 10,000 or per 100,000 that you need, both cities were dramatically lower than where they were supposed to be. And then came the pandemic and the riots and the George Floyd garbage and the mobs in the street saying defund the cops, and they got lower still. And so is Seattle making up some of that ground, or are they just kind of treading water?
Well, they're trying. We've got all these, lateral bonuses, new hire bonuses, massive recruiting efforts. So far on the year, 60 new Seattle cops are on the job through the month of April. Now, that is, that is up from last year. The question being raised, I think rightly so, by the president of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, Union President Mike Solon. When I spoke to him last week, Lars, he said, here are our concerns. They've got several, but one of their main concerns is the caliber of the candidate. And I got it confirmed from Seattle Police that, yes, you can come in as a new recruit, right? You've signed up, and they've had like more than 1,200 applications come in through the first quarter of this year, which is huge. It's like double the number through this period last year. The problem is these guys can come in, and take your polygraph. We're going to make sure that you're not a jerk and don't, didn't kill somebody in another state. That's probably question number one. Many of these guys are failing one or multiple questions on the polygraph and still moved along in the process. And SPD confirmed that for me last week.
Hold on. They have good reason. I mean, polygraphs are not admissible in court, but they are a good tool. And they've got reason to believe that an officer candidate is lying when they answer the interview questions and they still say, oh, that's okay. You can come on in and maybe become a cop.
Well, and in fairness to them, I don't know what questions they're failing. I assume if they say, you know, have you buried somebody in your backyard? And the guy says, no, and the polygraph thing goes crazy. They're like, okay, you're out. But if they ask you something like, you know, have you ever driven drunk? And the guy says, no, and then maybe it shows something questionable. You know, they are passing these folks along because they are so desperate for qualified candidates. And that is the concern being raised by the Guild. And Mike Solon said, you know, okay, maybe 90 out of 100 of these guys should be passed along, even if there was some gray area on the polygraph. The problem is you get these folks out there on the street. It takes them many years. As you know, when you're a brand new police officer, right, you get paired up with a veteran. It's going to take them years to move on. The problem is all the guys that are getting paired up as veterans, you've got more than 20% of the current Seattle police officer force eligible for retirement this year. 53 and older, 20 years plus. Many of these guys are like, you know, we're done. We're done with the city, the caliber of the new candidates coming in. I don't want to be on the same force with some of these guys, or we're just done with the politics of this city.
Well,
so even though they've hired 60, we're going to lose more.
Yeah, and in fact, I looked that up, and I think they're underestimated. They said they expect to lose 30 to 40 this year. Well, that's 60 in, 30 to 40 out. It means you're making a tiny incremental difference of maybe 20 additional cops compared to last year. But you're not making up the ground. They're, what, 700 sworn officers right now? They're going to have a problem. And let me tell you about the lying stuff, Carlene. Can you imagine it when the first defense attorney goes in and says, he's got an officer on the stand who's testifying against his client. And he says, you got into the Seattle Police Department, didn't you? Yes. And you had to be polygraphed. Yes. And did the polygraph indicate to you that you were lying and that that showed up on your polygraph? Well, yeah, it did. And you know, they're going to be off to the races. Any competent defense attorney is, and there's a thing called the Brady list, that if an officer has ever been found to have fabricated anything, lied about anything, that person is dead as far as an asset in any kind of investigation, because the defense attorneys will rip him apart on the stand and say, well, if you lied to get the job, would you lie to make the case against my client? I know exactly how they'll do it. And so when Seattle PD has a policy that will take people, even if they show up dirty on the polygraph, doesn't sound like it's going to work out well in the long term.
Well, and mind you, they're luring all kinds of guys that want to, I mean, you know, sign up for the job, for crying out loud. You would. They're the best paid police agency, any law enforcement agency in the state right now. And as Mike Solon, the Guild president, points out, he goes, we should be. You know, the guys that have stuck around through all of this defund stuff and the massive scrutiny, you know, with the federal government stuff, that they're still under the scrutiny of some of that stuff from years ago. You know, they are the most scrutinized police agency, some argue, in the entire country. And so the guys that have stuck around 20, 25 years, but still don't have the political backing. And on top of that, Lars, they've got all of these, you know, left-leaning advocacy groups that are in the back pocket of some of your Seattle City Council members and others in city government that are saying, hey, wait a minute, whoa, you know, let's just assume all cops are bad guys. Let's start scrutinizing their body cam and voice, you know, recording.
How would you like to be working in that kind of environment? That's Carlene Johnson. She's a reporter with the Center Square.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Lars finally agree with Chuck Schumer?
Of course there's some wasteful spending, but you don't use a meat axe and cut everything.
Pass out the chainsaws and welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I got my chainsaw. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly. We all know that Dr. Anthony Fauci, a lot of people like me call him Dr. Fauci, left the government as the highest paid bureaucrat. Well, now he's worth about $15 million. So exactly how sweet was his golden parachute, and our taxpayers still on the hook? Jeremy Portnoy joins me now, investigative journalist and author of Open the Books, Waste of the Day column at Real Clear. Jeremy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Did I get that right? Is it realclear.com or .org? It didn't say on my notes, so I can't remember. I think it's
realclearinvestigations.com.
Very good. So tell me this. Fauci, to me, just seems pure evil. I think he lied to us. I think he encouraged other scientists to lie. He's got all those things going against him. And he was notoriously the highest paid bureaucrat anywhere in the American government. And as I understand the numbers, he came into the pandemic worth about $5 million net worth because he had to disclose those things. And by the time the pandemic ended just a few years later, he was worth about 12. And now we're told he's worth about 15. If I'm wrong on those numbers, please feel free to correct me, Jeremy.
He started a bit higher than that. He started at $7.5 million before the pandemic. But still, we saw his net worth increase throughout the whole thing. And like you said, this new data that we've just obtained shows that his assets climbed by $3.5 million in 2023. So now he's worth just over $15 million in total.
Wow. And where did the money come from, and how much of it was tied directly to his work for the government?
So we don't know entirely where it came from. We only know the total number. But we can see some large deposits in these documents, right? In November 30th, 2023, he made a deposit of $700,000. Another one for $150,000 a couple months before that. Looking around, you know, his schedule from the time, we can make some educated guesses, right? He got a prize from Columbia University at the time for $50,000. Another one from the National Academy of Medicine for $40,000. Took a job with Georgetown University as a professor. We don't know what he was earning there, but that certainly contributed. So he was really, you know, capitalizing on his public profile and his image from the pandemic to really cash in and rake in these millions.
I guess, am I right in suspecting that there may be, with Fauci, some of the same kind of, I call it money laundering, that they did with Joe Biden, where Joe Biden goes in and he has a little think tank kind of arrangement with UPenn. And then as soon as they put him on the salary for, I think it was $1 million for 2 years of not teaching at UPenn, the Chinese write a giant check for a much larger amount than they usually would give to UPenn. And it would very much appear that the Chinese money came in about the time that Joe Biden ended up on payroll. Are there any of those arrangements we can see from the public record that would explain why Fauci was getting all this money, or even the gigs at places like Georgetown? Because I wonder about that. If a foreign government, especially a foreign government like China, wants to put somebody on the payroll, they may not be able to write the check directly, but they call their friends at a university. They say, we're going to make a bigger donation this year, and we really love that Tony Fauci.
We can't tell for sure if the money in his bank account came from foreign sources or not. We do know that at the time, a lot of scientists in his agency, the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, they were receiving royalty payments on medicines they'd helped invent from countries all around the world. For the first time in 2023, there were more royalty payments from foreign countries, from foreign companies than there were from domestic companies. So that's been happening over a long time. We're seeing more and more foreign influence going into the NIH and different government doctors.
What else do we know from the books? Because I want people to read your column, but give them a taste of what else we know about Fauci. And does it sound like he's going to continue to make large dollars in his post-federal employment time?
Well, another big thing we just found out is that he's been misrepresenting his retirement date for a long time. He actually testified to Congress that he retired on December 27, 2022. We just got his emails. We found out he actually stayed on until January of 2023. And he was doing that to finish an agreement with the U.S. Marshals Services to get a private security detail for $15 million after he had already retired. And he was still accepting taxpayer funding for the security when he was just a private citizen.
Oh, hold on. So by staying an extra, what, couple of months? Or was it a year that he stayed extra, that he was able to qualify for? And what was it he got from the U.S. Marshals? He got special security?
Yeah, it was only about an extra week he stayed on, but he stayed to finalize that agreement. And for the next year and a half, the Marshals Service was providing him with a private chauffeur, a private security detail, paying salaries and benefits for all these staff to protect him, even though, as we just discussed, he was more than capable of paying for that himself. He had millions sitting in a bank account. If he wanted security, he could have hired that on his own as a private citizen. Instead, he billed taxpayers the full $15 million.
Jeremy, thank you very much. That's Jeremy Portnoy. You can read all the details in the Waste of the Day column at RealClearInvestigations.com. Jeremy, thank you. Let's go to Alex. Hey, Alex, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call. On the $5,000 incentive on having babies,
yeah,
I feel like that is just a drop in the ocean. It's a good start, but I think you ought to do something better to promote this. Those folks that just had a baby recently, they know that even before you have a baby, all the doctor's visits, all the extra stuff you have to get ready for, it's going to, you know, that $5,000 is going to get eaten away.
We already give people a tax deduction for a kid. We give them a child care tax credit. And then if you had $5,000, that would be very, very generous. And I very much appreciate the call. By the way, thanks a lot, Alex.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And try this for provocative. Why is Seattle so tolerant of lawbreakers as long as they announce loudly their hatred of Jewish people? I thought I'd start with that with Ari Hoffman, my friend who's the host of the Ari Hoffman Show on our Seattle affiliate station, KVI. Ari, welcome back.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here, buddy.
Will Jew hatred get you out of almost any kind of legal trouble in the city of Seattle?
It seems like it, but now there might be a little caveat to that. If Donald Trump puts you on a list for having your federal funding taken away, then as a university, you might actually say it's time we deal with the anti-Semitism on campus. Because what happened last night at the University of Washington is you had all these Hamasniks and Antifa activists who took over an engineering building, a brand new engineering building, started building barricades out of the furniture, all to protest Israel and UW's relationship with Boeing, who, of course, as we know, is a weapons supplier, and they were freaking out over that. But what was interesting was, don't forget, last year we had the Gaza encampment at University of Washington. They didn't do anything about it for a month. But here they got rid of it the same night, and all of a sudden, Anna Marie Cauchy, who's the president of University of Washington, is releasing statements that she should have released 2 years ago after October 7th, and you got to assume the reason is now University of Washington is on the chopping block for federal funding. So it looks like all we needed was a new president.
All you needed was to threaten their cash, because apparently what they claim to be their values, I don't admire their values. Usually when they come out and say, we support the values of free speech. Well, so do I. I don't support the value of free speech when you've barricaded yourself inside of a building. Those are two different things. And especially you, I think you posted this about the group that was in there. We are taking this building amidst the current renewed wave of student intifada struggle following the uprising of Student Action for Palestine and the heroic victory of the Al-Aqsa flood on October 7th. The flood is apparently a reference to the slaughter of 1,200 human beings, but apparently the group that took over the building is saying, yeah, that was a great thing that shattered the illusion of Zionist imperialist domination and brought Palestine to the forefront for all justice-loving people. Yeah, for all the people who said slaughtering 1,200 people, great way to get people's attention, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely insane. And intifada means an armed uprising. In the intifada in the year 2000, over 1,000 people in Israel were killed. And they weren't just Jews. They were Christians. They were Muslims as well. A lot of innocent civilians because the Muslims decide to have an intifada. Well, now they're talking about a student intifada. And when you had last year on campus where students are getting assaulted, students are getting blocked, students are getting spit on, how soon until it actually turns into something much, much worse? That's literally what they're calling for. Al-Aqsa flood was the name of the operation on October 7th by Hamas, to go and kill as many Jews as possible and take as many hostages as they could. These guys are literally calling for another one at the University of Washington. This student group, Super UW, this pro-Hamas student group, was banned from campus last year for vandalizing the Husky Union building, the big student center, and they caused over $50,000 worth of damage. They were banned as an official student group, but they were still allowed to table on campus. So you ban these guys for being part of a terrorist organization, but you still allow them to recruit on campus. And just a couple weeks ago, I posted a video. They were selling T-shirts which were glorifying terrorists, glorifying October 7th, and printing out material that had Hamas's logo on it that they admitted came from the Hamas Media Center. This is what University of Washington has been allowing on campus.
Okay, and there's the mystery. Why? I mean, I will ask for an interview with the president of the university. I imagine you do the same thing, and I imagine we'll both have about the same luck. Is it reasonable to ask her, why would you allow these people to have anything to do with your campus? I mean, I understand it's a piece of public property. On the other hand, people get banned from public property all the time. If you behave badly on Sound Transit, you get banned from transit. If you behave badly on the Max Light Rail Line in Portland, you get banned. If you behave badly on in a public building, you can be 86 from a public building because of your bad behavior. Why are they allowing it to happen?
Exactly. Well, here's the problem. A lot of it is their faculty. A lot of their faculty agrees with them. These faculty are the aging hippies from the 60s and 70s, wish they could be out on the quad with them, and a lot of them actually are. The Jewish Studies Department at the University of Washington has been completely taken over by anti-Israel, anti-Jewish psychopaths, most of whom are not even Jewish. In the other worlds, we call that cultural appropriation. But here, they're perfectly fine with it because they're teaching their worldview, that Judaism is not a religion. Judaism is some kind of social advocacy group for the Democrat Party. And that's how they're using the Jewish Studies Department. University of Washington was found to have one of the most anti-Semitic faculties and campuses in the entire U.S. And right now, Anna Marie Cauchy is between a rock and a hard place. Does she lose her federal funding from the Trump administration? Or does she challenge her own faculty? Does she agree with her own faculty? That's the predicament she's in right now, and she's thinking, I'm out of here in June anyway. I don't want to deal with this, and I don't want to be the one who lost us the federal funding. Let that be the next guy's problem.
So she's just watching the clock until it's over. And frankly, I'd point this out. For anybody who says, well, I'm not Jewish, why do I care about this? I'm Christian. And I'm well aware that the same people who hate the Jews out of these groups, the Palestinians, they hate the rest of us as well. And it is purely motivated by their religious beliefs and that and I guess their attempt to get, you know, like I said, almost everything motivated on earth is motivated by money, sex, or power, or a combination of the three. But they're putting out rallying cries. This is, again, from that statement. We call on you to besiege the buildings and the offices of the corporations that finance the Zionist entity, which I think includes both Jews and Christians because they're talking about the United States, and arm its criminal army with all kinds of bombs and means of death and destruction. If you're over at Boeing, you better hope the locks on the doors hold.
Yeah, and don't forget this also, Lars. These are people who burn the American flag on the University of Washington campus. So these are people who hate America regardless of whatever religion a person is, whether it's Jewish, Christian, Muslim, because if you're a Muslim who's living in America that doesn't see their worldview, they hate you also. They want to kill you also. These are people who hate Western civilization and want to bring it down completely, regardless of the religious in nature. Of course, if it's Jews, of course, if it's Christians, these are people who just want Islamophobia, fascism all over the world, and then they're useful idiots who are the white kids on college campuses who go, oh, this is tolerance, and don't realize that they would get thrown off a roof by the people in Hamas if they were in Gaza.
I guess the only reason I disparage the president of the University of Washington is she's saying we have all these values, but we'll give them up if you give us enough dollars. And to me, that's suggesting if you can be bought, then as a university president, you're not just a university president, you're something else. And all we're doing now is negotiating the price. Ari, thank you very much. That's Ari Hoffman. He hosts the show on our Seattle affiliate, KVI. Ari, it's always a pleasure. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Do you get?
Naysayers go to the head of the line at the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. But I want to ask you this. How do you pull off one of the biggest and most offensive race hoaxes in America? And then you manage to skate entirely on the criminal charges for having pulled off that crime. And then on top of that, you get paid by the government because you were the person who was hurt. Now, the only person who can really understand that is both a lawyer and a former district attorney, and that's Josh Marquis, member of the board of the Criminal Justice Truth Project. Hey, Josh, welcome back, and I really do want to talk about Jussie Smollett and what has just happened with his settlement and his payout and the fact that he's walking away without any criminal conviction at all.
It's horrific. Jussie Smollett is sort of a minor actor who is in a serious called Empire, but he's from a fairly well-known acting family. So essentially, a couple years ago, he stages a completely fake attack, which he claims are two Trumpsters who he claims try to hang him. He's a black man, and screaming "Make America Great Again," and this is in the middle of a blizzard in Chicago. Very quickly becomes clear that this is a hoax. It's not true. He's filed false police reports, and it turns out the two African immigrants have, in fact, you know, were part of a scheme he had to basically create publicity for himself. So the case falls apart. But then now,
by the way, can I throw into that? He wanted publicity because apparently he was making about $1.5 million a year, and he was convinced that his skills and talents were actually worth considerably more than that. Yeah. And he wanted to get a raise. Now, a lot of people do a lot of crazy things to get a raise, but not many of them say, I think I'll pretend that I was walking to the Subway sandwich shop at 2 o'clock in the morning in the winter in Chicago in a predominantly black neighborhood. And then I'm going to claim that a couple of white guys wearing MAGA hats just happened to be walking through the same neighborhood, predominantly black neighborhood, at the same time. What's that? With a noose in their possession, and that they encountered me and recognized me. And Josh, I would say this. I have a feeling that a lot of people who watch BET or other channels might say, well, I recognize Jussie Smollett from Empire. I'm willing to bet that most of the folks who are Trump followers and MAGA hat wearers probably couldn't have picked Jussie Smollett out of a lineup. But that was his story, and he stuck to it for a time.
Actor. It gets worse, though. It gets worse. So he should, of course, have been charged with crime. But the then state's attorney, district attorney of Chicago, was a woman named Kim Fox, a real Soros winner who is since, thank goodness, no longer in office. She refuses to charge him with anything. But fortunately, a retired judge files a motion saying, absolutely not. This guy committed a crime. He's got to be prosecuted. The case goes forward. It goes to trial. He's convicted of filing false reports. He throws a terrible temper tantrum, which is televised, which is, you're all racist, and I'm going to die. They're going to hang me in jail. He ends up spending 2 or 3 days in jail, gets bailed out. And the conviction is affirmed at one level, but then eventually the Illinois Supreme Court, a notoriously political of my party, the Democratic Party, and part of the Illinois
Democratic
Party.
I don't know why you stay in that party, Josh, by the way.
Well, I don't know either sometimes. Yeah. They very recently have said, oh, no, you know, what Kim Fox, the original DA, said, that was the end of it. So we're reversing your conviction. So the city of Chicago, also run by a bunch of crooks and thugs, has just announced that they're going to pay money to Jussie Smollett for basically him having ripped off the system and lied and exacerbated racial tensions at a time in America when it couldn't possibly be worse.
No, and the fact is they're paying him specifically for false arrest, and yet his arrest was not a false arrest, was it?
No, it was not. It was a righteous prosecution. I mean, this is where, you know, famously William Blackstone, Sir William Blackstone, the English legal scholar said, "Sir, the law is an ass." And this is one of those times when it really is, because the reality is he did commit a crime. He was rightfully held accountable to it. But because the pins were pulled underneath the prosecution for purely political reasons by essentially corrupt officials of the Illinois Democratic Party, we pretend that the conviction didn't occur, ergo the crime didn't occur, ergo we have to cross his palm with many pieces of silver or gold, and he will have no record. I suspect, I looked him up very briefly before the show to see what his credits were, and he has been in one self-produced TV show in the last 4 years.
Yeah, so basically his career, because he wasn't happy making $1.5 million a year for a show that showed to a fairly limited audience, and he thought he deserved a raise. He didn't get the raise. He got prosecuted instead. And instead of becoming some kind of hero to the left, I think even the left doesn't really want to know much about him anymore, because I don't think they see him as an asset. I think they see him as a tremendous liability, and they don't want to be reminded of Jussie Smollett.
No, and but he, you know, there are second acts in America and sometimes third acts, and we probably won't be seeing the last of him. But it's really, really shameful. I mean, there are people who are wrongfully prosecuted, and there are people who deserve compensation. He is not one of them.
No, and in fact, one of the things that works against this, Josh, is that almost every time I hear about something that's supposedly an act of racial prejudice or even religious prejudice, I'll hear about, you know, a church that's been burned. I'll hear about somebody who's had, you know, horrible symbols carved on their lawn, things like that. And you say, okay, is this one real? Because a stunning number of those incidents
are fakes.
Are fakes. And they're fakes for the crassest of motives. I want to make more money. I want to get sympathy. I want everybody to feel sorry for me. And basically, I want more money. And at the end of all of that, you say, hold on, aren't you doing damage to the very people who actually are, in some cases, discriminated against and deserve some kind of recognition or some kind of compensation? Yeah. But people like this go in and they steal all this thunder and claim they're the victims. And they know that in many cases, people are going to be afraid to ask, is this real? Even though they have good reason to make that question.
And yes, that's happened, frankly, here in Portland. People that may not remember, there was a woman who happened to be lesbian who was a police officer and claimed that crosses were being burned on her lawn. You may remember this one.
I do.
And the Portland Police Bureau did a surveillance, and she was supposedly confined to a wheelchair, and they see her get up out of her wheelchair, walk out onto the lawn of her house, and plant the cross and set it on fire. This is about 20 years ago, but
all of that to get some extra attention. And usually at the end of the day, there's some money involved in all of it. Josh, thanks very much. I appreciate it. That's Josh Markey, former district attorney and now with the Criminal Justice Truth Project. Fact is, we should take, and I would think that even the people of color in this country would say, if you decide to fake a race crime against yourself and you do it for all those crass motives, you should suffer, not the rest of us. Glad to be with you and glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Check out our Instagram feed and our other social media.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Exercising the right to free speech every day. This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you on in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And always glad to take your calls. We'll get to your calls in a moment. But I thought I'd pose this question. I kind of posed it last week after the big bust of a drug cartel kingpin living in Salem and apparently involved in what ranks as the single largest seizure of fentanyl in American history. Almost 900 pounds of fentanyl, about 400 kilograms, as well as millions of pills and all kinds of other things. And in Salem, they found this guy with $2.8 million in cash, guns, nice cars, the whole nine yards, none of the product with him, of course. And then at that point, you're reminded that Oregon law enforcement is forbidden by state law to help out in arresting these people who are not just illegally in our country, but are committing crimes like that that lead to the deaths of far too many Americans. I thought we'd talk about it with Representative Christine Drazen, who is House Minority Leader. Representative Drazen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Good to be here.
Is there a way to, I'm glad you're here. Is there a way to force a vote, even though I know the Democrats will vote yes on sanctuary and no on getting rid of it, but is there a way to get them to put themselves on the record saying we want Oregon to stay a sanctuary state and places like Portland to stay sanctuary cities, even though they attract people like this drug kingpin that they just busted?
You know, I love that you're asking that question because we were asking the same question and we called the question. We brought the bill to the floor. So we did what's called a bill pull last week. The bill was House Bill 3551, which would scrap Oregon's existing sanctuary state laws and it would allow law enforcement to work with federal law enforcement, specifically around people who are violent criminals. They've been convicted of violent felonies, and that bill didn't pass the floor. We got 29 votes. You need 31 to pass. But here's the thing. We had four House Republican members that could not be on the floor on that day, which means that we'll bring the bill back. We're going to bring it back. And all of those Democrats need to continue to stick with us, in which case House Bill 3551 will pass the floor.
It will pass the floor, and then what happens likely in the Senate? If you hold their feet to the fire and say, are you really going to endorse sanctuary status for the state, knowing the kind of damage that it does, what's your prediction about what Democrats in the Senate would do with it?
Well, I actually think that Democrats in the House are going to get cold feet. I don't want them to. I want them to stick with the principles, because Oregonians are less safe with the sanctuary state laws we have in place right now. It's time to scrap this old law and recognize the world is a much more dangerous place today. So I would love to get out of the House. I'd love to force the question in the Senate. And I actually think that there should be bipartisan support for this to be able to change these laws so that Oregonians are safer. But we've got to get it over to them first. So we're going to take another run at this when we have a full complement of all of our Republican members on the floor. And we're going to give these Democrats an opportunity to stick with their principles.
Okay, I want to ask something because I've never covered the legislature just, you know, as a beat to cover even back in the day. So I want to know if you're being too generous to the Democrats by saying maybe they'll get cold feet. Did some of these, or did most of the Democrats who voted to end the sanctuary status, did they do it by counting noses saying this thing's going to get beat anyway, so it gives me the freedom to vote yes on ending sanctuary status, knowing the votes aren't there, so I can safely cast a vote, and then I can run around at election time and say, I voted against sanctuary status, or am I being too harsh?
You are not being too harsh. It's called political cover, and we're going to call their hands. Like, we're going to force the issue again, because I believe that they're taking a vote that's an accurate vote right where Oregonians are. The vast majority of Oregonians, 70% of Oregonians, support deporting illegal immigrants who have been convicted of a crime. Like, how can you be opposed to that?
Well,
so,
and in fact,
no, I don't think you're being overly generous.
I know this poll that was done by Republicans where they said to Oregonians in a poll, are you in favor of deporting undocumented immigrants, I call them illegal aliens because it's more accurate, who have been convicted of a crime? I wish they'd asked the question without the convicted of another crime, because being here illegally is mm-hmm. against the law. But if they had done that nationwide, as I understand it, there's still a solid majority of all Americans who want all illegals deported, whether they've committed another crime on top of their immigration crime or not. Do you know if the poll got into that number at all?
I don't believe the poll asked anything but convicted of a crime, you know, while here in Oregon. But that's also what our legislation asked. And so this legislation should have been a no-brainer. Let's say, you know, let's say that in Oregon those numbers don't match federal numbers, and I don't have that data, so I'm not sure. But I can tell you that 70% of Oregonians want people that have been convicted of these serious violent crimes out. They want safe communities and neighborhoods. Republican legislation does that. And we believe that it should pass both chambers and that Oregonians deserve to be safe in their communities. This is how you get that done. And we saw from the bust in Salem, the multi-state bust, that this stuff is real. It's happening in our communities. And there, and the fact that we have local law enforcement whose hands are tied, can't work with the feds on this stuff, is making Oregonians less safe today.
Well, and I'm generally pro-law enforcement, but this was a big disappointment, because I want you to notice the dog that didn't bark, Representative Drazen, and that is local police in Salem missed this. Sheriff's office in Marion County missed this. State police in Oregon missed this. And it took the federal government to come in and arrest this guy and tie him into this interstate network of fentanyl distributors in the western United States, including places like Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and I would guess probably California and Oregon, and maybe Washington State as well. So this guy's sitting there right in front of, you know, everybody, and who has to do the job? The federal government. But it also means that if the state police had somehow encountered this guy in Salem and said, hey, there's something funny about a guy sitting on $2.8 million in cash and guns and all these other things. If they had, correct me if I'm wrong, the law would have said, and you're not allowed to call ICE and have this guy removed.
Yeah, that's completely true. You're reading the law perfectly. They may not communicate with ICE. I mean, they risk their own, their personal risk if they call ICE.
Because they can be fired. I don't know if they can be prosecuted or not, but they can be fired from a police job.
Yes.
You've seen that happen in Washington State, where there was even the accusation that a state trooper had picked up the phone and called a friend in ICE and said, hey, this guy is sitting here in the jail. They're not allowed to do that. And I can't believe that a majority of Oregonians would support that. If it doesn't, if you can get it past the House, is there any way to get a referendum sent to the people? Because I have a feeling, Representative Drazen, that if you put this to a vote, that sanctuary status would go down hard.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think Oregon, that just, things have changed. Things have changed in our state. This is a day-to-day risk. People are dying. Once fentanyl hit our streets, once our entire state was turned upside down by addiction, once crime skyrocketed to support this addiction that we have across all categories, young, old, everything in between, I think that Oregonians feel it. And so, yeah, I'm with you. I think Oregonians are ready to change this policy.
Well, I do have to, just for clarity, I've never changed on this. I want illegal aliens out of my country. I always have. I always will. When the state of Oregon and the legislature decided we're going to give driver's licenses to illegals, and then the public had to rescind it 2-1, and then the legislature said we're going to do it anyway, and now we've got illegal aliens that we're finding in the voter rolls. Representative Drazen, keep up the fight. We appreciate it. We'll keep checking in with you. That's Representative Christine Drazen, who's the House Minority Leader.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The sound of freedom. Here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday. How often do you think does somebody run for the state legislature of one state and then find himself forced to attend hearings about agencies from another state just to be able to do his job correctly? Well, the guy who's got that feeling right now is State Representative John Lee. Now, in theory, he represents Washington State District 18 Position 2. And yet there he was at the Oregon Transportation Commission meeting last week to get an update on a project that very much has consequences, at least potential consequences, for District 18 in an entirely different state, the state of Washington. Representative Lee, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on. As always, you've got to wear many hats in order to serve the people, and I'm delighted to be here with you and your audience today.
So I want to get into some of the things you heard at this meeting, because I have a feeling the mainstream media did not communicate most of this to the public. But the first place I'd like to start is with the mayor of Vancouver. We have invited her many times to come on this show. She doesn't especially want to answer questions because we would ask her about things that you cite. For example, she says why they when they build that brand new bridge for billions of dollars, we don't know exactly how many billions because the number keeps going up, that the maximum toll anybody will pay for driving down the freeway is $1.75. Is that true?
It's fantasy for you and me, and the reality is no, but she's hanging her hat on numbers that the Washington State Transportation Commission put out about 2 years ago, where they created four different scenarios, and the low end of the tolls in those scenarios was $1.55, and the high end was $4.70. And so while she could theoretically say, hey, the best tolls are going to be $1.75, it's hogwash for a whole lot of reasons.
So in other words, she's is it fair to say, it may not be polite, but is it fair to say that Ann McInerney Ogle, mayor of Vancouver, is in fact lying to the public?
She's being disingenuous, to put it politely, my friend.
Okay, and I know when you're in the legislature, you have to be very polite. So tell me about this. The Oregon Transportation Commission has this meeting, and a lot of it had to do with not only a project, the Rose Quarter project in the Portland Metro, but also about the interstate bridge replacement. What stunning things did we find out?
Well, there were three different things of interest to the majority of the people. In the past, we'd been told that the project would be complete within 10 years. Now they're suddenly saying it could be 15 years of possible construction. So that's a 50% increase. And of course, Greg Johnson, the program administrator, has been browbeating people saying every year you delay this, that's going to add $300 million a year in cost. Well, right there, if he's been honest, that's an extra $1.5 billion added to the cost, number one. Number two, there is apparently only one bidder to be the general contractor for the entire project. Well, of course, you and I know if you have no competition to manage the whole project, oh my gosh, stand by, because you're going to get ripped off one way or another on money being incorrectly funneled in so many bad ways.
Well,
so that's bad.
John, it also makes me wonder. You say there's this multi-billion dollar construction project. You would think that would be a general contractor's dream. I mean, most contractors, you do a $100,000 job, and I don't know what you make, $15,000 on it. If you're talking about a multiple billion dollar project and you're going to be the general contractor, you'd think people would be lining up for the job. Do you have any idea why they were only able to find one company that was willing to even bid on the job? And what does that say about the job itself?
Well, so they didn't go into details. They said they were going to restructure their bidding process, hoping to attract another bidder or two, but they didn't go into any details. And in a sense, unbelievably, nobody from the Oregon Transportation Commission delved into that problem. And so it's just a huge warning sign for people like you and me that says, warning, my pocket's about to be ripped off. And with no legitimate oversight currently to date, this bodes very, very ill for the whole project.
Go ahead.
No, and so I was going to say, finally, the third thing that is of interest to our citizens here in the greater Portland metro and the southwest Washington area is that the starting time for tolling, and they're going to do tolls, what they call pre-construction, it's been kicked back almost a year to the spring of 2027. And again, that's an indication that they are having some problems executing their original plan. But that's good for people from the perspective of, hey, the government's going to pick their pockets later than when that's going to come. And so people can breathe a small sigh of relief. But bottom line, as you and I have talked many times, we just need to not let the camel's nose into the tent. We need to kill the tolling on this all the way and come in with a reasonably priced project that could be in the $1 billion, $1.5 billion range and just build a very simple bridge without light rail, with all the bells and whistles, and serve the people well.
That's John Lee, who's a representative, District 18, Position 2, and Ann McInerney Ogle is still invited to come on and explain why she's lying to the public about tolling.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson